To that hymn as we get started here this morning. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares I have already come. 'Tis grace has brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. Those are some of the words to the well-known hymn, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound. And that hymn reflects something about life that we realize, that we recognize just by common living, you know, the way that we live, we see these kinds of truth. We understand that life is hard, and that's something that this song speaks to. That there are toils and trials associated with life, that there are snares in our path, as the hymn states. Life is hard. Suffering is real. That's another thing that we learn from life. Another thing that we see in this hymn, that suffering is real. But one of the things that is unique about the Christian life, one of the things that is unique about living life for God, according to the gospel, is that Christians have a mechanism to get through these trials, to get through these sufferings. Christians have hope. Christians have a mechanism to endure the trials, and that is the hope that we have in Jesus' resurrection. We can look back and see the historical evidence for the resurrection of Christ, and because of that, we can look forward in hope to the fact that God will one day raise us from the dead. In fact, that's Peter's point throughout the whole book of 1 Peter, isn't it? That we have a hope to endure trials. Yes, you may be strangers and aliens in a land that you don't belong in. Yes, you may experience suffering and pain and death and all of the horrible things that go along with that. But God has given us the hope of resurrection. That's what Peter states specifically in chapter 1. That you have been born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We need to live like that, Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2 and 3. We need to be people who behave excellently, people who submit to suffering, people who rise above the suffering and the pain to live a life through suffering, to maintain excellent and godly behavior despite what's going on around us. Because when we do that, Peter says, we bring glory and honor to God. We declare the excellencies of God. But one of the things that we need to realize about suffering, and if we stop reading the book of 1 Peter at about halfway through chapter 4, we might come to the conclusion that Christians have a coping mechanism through suffering. That Christians have a means by which they can cope with suffering. But what I want you to understand, and what I think Peter is really getting at in this book, is that our mechanism to get through suffering is not just a means to cope with suffering. It's not just a means to sort of keep us bobbing above water so we can, you know, just sort of make it through life. That's not what Peter is talking about. That's not what the hope of Christianity is. Christians don't cope with suffering. Christians don't cope with suffering. Christians thrive through suffering. Christians live a life that is full of joy despite their suffering. That's why Peter puts it in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12, that we are to keep on rejoicing so that they also at the revelation of His glory may rejoice with great exultation. It's verse 13. Keep on rejoicing. He's just written a whole book about suffering and about pain and about alienation and about being strangers and pilgrims in a place that you don't belong. And then he comes down to the end of the book and he says, keep on rejoicing. I want to explore with you a little bit how Peter ends this book. I want to share with you what I hope will be encouragement, not so that you will leave this building and have a coping mechanism for suffering, not so that you will leave this building only thinking about how to get through another day, but so that you'll understand that the hope of resurrection that we have provides us joy in our suffering. And that's really what suffering is. The suffering that we have in Christ is a joy. As Peter puts it, there is joy associated with suffering. Look at chapter 4, verse 12. This is where we're going to begin our study. Chapter 4, verse 12, he says, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the suffering of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exultation. He opens there with verse 12, and he makes it very clear that we're not to be people who are surprised by our suffering. We shouldn't be taken off guard by the suffering that comes our way. Have you ever noticed that that is the initial reaction when people suffer? There's this initial kind of shock when we suffer. And I think we see that in other people when we look around us and we see people suffering. I think we see it in our own self. And I don't think this is something that is hard to see in our own selves, that we're shocked that suffering would come upon us. How often have you said things like this, or have you heard people say things like, "How could this have happened to me? How could God have let this happen? Why me?" Right? These are the kinds of questions we hear when suffering comes. These are the kinds of questions we ask. Why me? Why is this happening? How could this be? The ironic thing is, we know from our experiences that good people suffer. We know looking around us that good people suffer. In fact, we even talk that way. We have phrases that allude to this. There have been whole songs, popular songs written about why the good die young. And wasn't it Billy Joel who wrote a song about that? Only the good die young, right? That's something we know. We recognize that intuitively. Good people suffer. We see it in our own lives. You know, we're good people and yet we suffer. The ironic thing is, we know that good people suffer, and yet we're still surprised when it happens. Peter says, don't be surprised. Don't be surprised. When you suffer, when you have pain, when you face death, don't be surprised. Peter tells us, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, as though some strange thing were happening to you. This is not an unusual thing. As Christians trying to model our lives after the suffering Christ, we will suffer. That's a guarantee. In fact, Jesus made that guarantee to us back in John. When Jesus is talking to his disciples in John chapter 15, verses 18 and 19, he says, if the world hates me, don't think that they're not going to hate you. If the world caused me to suffer, don't think that it's not going to cause you to suffer. We will suffer. We will experience pain. Don't be surprised when that comes your way. Get past that initial shock, Peter says, because it's going to happen. Instead, he says in verse 13, to the degree that you share the suffering of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, he continues, you are blessed because of the spirit of glory and of the God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffer as murderer or thief or evildoer or as troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is to be ashamed. He is not to be ashamed, excuse me, but is to glorify God in this name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? Peter continues and he says, don't be surprised by this suffering, but rather realize that this suffering is cause for rejoicing. This suffering is a cause of joy. He describes it in verse 14, as a blessing. You are blessed if you suffer. Our rejoicing should be consistent with our suffering. In other words, they should be a one for one. When you suffer, you should rejoice. They go together. They go hand in hand. The more you suffer, the more you rejoice. You see, suffering for our allegiance to Christ, Peter says, is a sign that you're doing something right. Suffering for your allegiance to Christ is a sign that you're doing something right. That is to say, it's a sign that you truly belong to God. That's what he says. If you suffer, it is a sign that you have the Spirit of God and the glory of God upon you, that you belong to Him. Suffering alone is not the mark of belonging to God. After all, many people suffer for their bad choices. Many people suffer because of their sin. But suffering for Christ is a mark of God's ownership upon us. And because of that, suffering as a Christian can be a blessing. Suffering as a Christian can be a joy in our life. So how can this be? First Peter says, don't be surprised that you're going to suffer. First Peter says, don't be surprised, you're going to get really, really hurt. You're going to get banged up in this life. And then he turns around and says, it's a blessing. It's a good thing. It's a joy. How can we possibly come to conceive of this suffering that we go through as something to have joy in? How can we see suffering as an object of joy. Well, I think that's what he gets at in verse 17. When he talks about the judgment to come, how is it that suffering can be a good thing? Peter tells us it's because godly sufferers will be well in the judgment. They will be taken care of in the judgment. He says, for it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. Godly sufferers, Peter says, will be well in the judgment. He says there, the judgment is here. The time for judgment is here. This isn't the first time that Peter seems to be looking off into the future to end time kinds of events. He talks about the judgment being here in verse 17 of chapter 4. Earlier, last week, when we looked at chapter 4, verse 7, Peter has already said that the end of all things is near. Peter's getting these people's minds primed to look ahead to the future, not to be so concerned about what is going on in their present life, but rather what is going on in the future. But when we come down to verse 17, and Peter says that the time for judgment is already come, is here, it's present, we need to understand something about what Peter is talking about there. Peter is not saying there that judgment is near. I want you to notice that. Peter doesn't say judgment is near. That's what he says back in verse 7. The end is near, right? Peter doesn't say the judgment is near. What Peter says is that the judgment is here. We are living the judgment. Now, that's not to deny that there's going to be a future judgment. Other biblical texts describe that, but that's not what Peter's talking about here. Peter is talking about a very real, present judgment of God that is happening right now in your life and in mine. This judgment is not necessarily a judgment of condemnation either, as we try to understand what this means. Sometimes we hear that word judgment and we think about bad things. God is going to judge the sinner. God is going to judge the wicked. But the fact is, this term judgment does not have any reference to whether what is being judged is being judged good or bad. This is simply the generic term for declaring a verdict. God is going to declare a verdict on you, whether you are His or whether you are not His, whether you are good or whether you are bad. According to Peter, God is beginning to draw eternal lines right now through the tests of our suffering. We are being proved to belong to God or being proved to be opposed to God. How we react to our suffering, how we engage with our suffering, whether or not we live with hope, whether or not we submit through suffering, how we live now declares to God where we will fall. And God's beginning to draw those lines now. God's verdict, Peter says, will begin with His own people. God is going to declare the righteous righteous now as we live. We will be tested now in this life. We will be tested with suffering and with pain and with trial. And we will be proven through those sufferings. God's people will be held up. The wheat will be separated from the chaff. Those who have substance, those who are God's, will be proven to be God's through their suffering. And guess what? Those who are not God's will be proven to be not His through their suffering. If our present suffering is God's means of testing us as to whether we are loyal to Him, as to whether we are committed to Him, which Peter says it is, how much worse will His testing of the wicked be? If this is what we go through, and we're God's people, and God is caring for us, and He's testing us, and He's proving us, how much more will those who are not His endure? Peter quotes here from Proverbs chapter 11, verse 31, when he says, if the righteous will be rewarded in the earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner? So rejoice in your suffering, Peter says. Suffering is a joy to those who are God's. Because of your suffering, God will judge you righteously. As you endure through those sufferings, as you handle the trials that come your way, God is determining your faithfulness to Him. Rejoice in that testing. Now that we know why our suffering is a joy, now that Peter says suffering is a joyous thing, it's a blessed thing, now that he says that, Peter gives us areas where this should be applied to our lives. Peter does this frequently in the book of 1 Peter, and it's great. Because we not only see the principles, but we see places in our lives where we can apply these principles. And as we go into chapter 5 of 1 Peter, that's exactly what Peter does. He's still thinking about the concept of suffering as a joy, suffering as something that should bring us joy, something that should be a blessing in our life. But now what he's going to do is he's going to turn to various individuals in various situations, and he's going to tell them that they need to apply that joyous way of suffering to their life, that they need to understand what's behind suffering, that it's the testing of God to determine the verdict of your soul, and that we need to live that way, that we need to realize that in our lives. Look at chapter 5, verse 1. Therefore, I exhort the elders among you, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Now, we'll pause there. Verse 5 is kind of connected to that. But we'll stop there at verse 4. And I want to point out to you what Peter's doing here in the first 5 verses. Peter is telling us that we need to serve others, that we need to serve one another joyfully. Elders, he says in verses 1 through 4, serve joyfully. It is interesting to me that Peter, while addressing this universal subject of suffering, something that we all experience, he stops to specifically address local church leaders. He could have addressed anyone, right? He could have talked about any group of people in the church. He could have talked about any group of people in the world because everybody suffers. This is a universal kind of concept. But remember, Peter says, as he's talking to local church leaders, the elders or the pastors or the bishops or the shepherds that are over the church, remember, local church leaders, that your suffering is a joyous thing. It is a thing to rejoice in. It is a blessing to you. Elders, Peter wants you to know that you should rejoice in your work despite the suffering, despite all of the bad things that go on as part of your work. And as we consider the work of elders, which we've done in the past, we should realize that shepherds do a very, very difficult job with very, very little thanks. They're more likely to be chided, to be second-guessed, to be slandered, to be threatened by their own flock, than they are to be thanked and praised and upheld as an example. We see that all too often in churches, not here necessarily, but we see that all over the place in various churches. That elders are trying to lead the flock, but their flock drags them down. Peter's encouragement to the elders here, to the shepherds of the flock of God, is to keep submitting to the suffering, keep enduring, keep leading, keep doing your job, and do it with joy. Look at specifically what Peter instructs the elders here. He offers some contrasts. The attitudes that elders shouldn't have versus the attitudes that they should have. He starts off and he says, shepherd the flock of God. There's the instruction. Do the work. Continue doing the work. Don't stop when things get hard. Don't stop when suffering comes. He says, don't do this work under compulsion, but rather do it voluntarily. Do you see the contrast there? Don't do it under compulsion because you're forced to, because you have to, because your arm has been twisted, but do it voluntarily because you love God and you love His people, and God's people need the leadership in the church. Don't do it for sordid gain, he says. Don't do it just to get some kind of monetary gain or some kind of gain in status or something like that. Don't do it for sordid gain, but do it with eagerness. Do it earnestly. Don't do it lording it over those who are entrusted to you, but do it proving to be an example to the flock. Those are some key contrasts here that Peter is making. On the one hand, is an eldership that is not shepherding the flock out of joy. Those elders look like people who are compulsed to do it. They are, you know, twisted their arm into doing so. Those elders are the ones, those who do not do it for joy, are those who are just out to get some kind of gain for their work. And very often, those elders are the ones that we end up seeing lording it over the flock. On the other hand, Peter says, is an eldership that is joyously suffering for God and his people. And those are the volunteers. Those are the ones who are eager to lead God's people. And those are the ones who prove to be the good examples that God's sheep should follow. Well, what is the result of this? Peter says, keep suffering, elders. Keep suffering and do it with a joyful attitude. Do it voluntarily. Do it eagerly. Do it as a good example to the flock. But what's the result? Remember what Peter said back in chapter 4 and verse 17. The time of judgment is already here. God is already testing us through our trials to prove who is faithful to him, who is loyal to him, who is committed to him. So what's the result, elders, of living a life that is committed to God, of living a life of suffering to the church? Look at chapter 5, verse 4. When the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. The chief shepherd will judge you righteous if you suffer joyfully, if you see your suffering as an object of joy. Verse 5, he continues. He's going to go to a new group of people. But he's still going to be talking about our need to serve one another, serve others joyfully. Verse 5, he talks to younger men. You younger men likewise be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Young men, Peter says, serve joyfully. Submit yourself to those who are over you. But the instruction to suffer joyously is not just for those who are in a leadership position. We need to understand that. The instruction to suffer joyously is not just for our elders, but it is for all of us. Now, Peter speaks here to the young men. He's, you know, sort of is addressing these young men here. And he says, young men, that you are to submit to the elders, subject yourselves to the elders. But I want to suggest to you that this is probably not meant to be restricted just to young men. Now, I think Peter's certainly applying it to young men, perhaps because young men are more likely to try to usurp some kind of authority for themselves. I don't know. But I want to suggest to you first that we find these kinds of instructions elsewhere for everyone. So although Peter addresses it specifically to young men, this is not something that young men just need to heed. Young men, young women, old women, subject yourselves to your elders. These are the kinds of things we see elsewhere in Scripture. But second, what I'd like to suggest to you is that probably what Peter is doing here is he's using young men as a contrast with elders. Elders suffer joyously. Young men suffer joyously as well. So I think what Peter's really getting at is not, you know, sorry, ladies, you're not involved here. I don't think that's what Peter's getting at. Rather, what he's saying is whether you're old or young, you need to submit. And we could probably take that a step further. Whether men or women, whoever you happen to be, whether you're in a leadership position or a service position, wherever you happen to be, listen up to what Peter's about to say. You young men also, be subject to your elders. Put yourself under their authority. Follow their lead. By the way, this sounds an awful lot like what Peter has already said in this book. Back in chapter 2, verse 13, all the way through chapter 3, verse 7, Peter addressed various places in life where we are to subject ourselves to others. Slaves, subject yourselves to masters. Citizens, subject yourselves to governments. Husbands, subject yourselves to wives. Wives, subject yourselves to husbands. Submit through suffering. That's what Peter's getting at here as well. Subject yourselves to your elders, those who are leading you in the local church setting. Be humble toward one another, he says. That is to say, consider others as more important than yourself. I mentioned a moment ago when we were talking about the elders, that elders often have a thankless job. That they are often doing work that is it goes unnoticed, that goes unthanked, that is rarely held up, and that's a shame. But elders are to continue doing that work anyway. The same can be true of all members wherever you happen to be, whatever you happen to be doing for the Lord's cause. You say, well, why are these reminders here? Why does Peter have to remind young men and all Christians, really, to be submissive to elders? Isn't it insensitive to suggest that sufferers should submit, right? That's sometimes the way we talk. Like, you know, we shouldn't try to encourage people who are already suffering to submit more, but that's exactly what Peter says. Submit further. Continue to suffer. Nothing is more disheartening than encountering ungodly leaders. And I'm not suggesting in the least that we have ungodly leaders among us. But some places do. And there may come a day when we do. And I want you to know that there is nothing more disheartening than encountering ungodly leaders. And for that matter, there's really nothing more disheartening either, in the same vein, than encountering ungodly brethren. People who we should be able to trust. People who we should be able to go to and lean on. And yet when we find those who are not committed to God, who are not truly living godly lives, that can be incredibly disheartening. Elders who do not follow God's pattern of leadership. Elders who take unrestrained controls. Elders who serve out of compulsion. All the things that Peter described earlier. Elders who do not follow God's pattern for leadership can cause so much stress and heartache and pain for the members of the flock that they serve. And in the same way, other Christians can be cruel and heartless from time to time. That is a reality that we will face. And if you don't face it here, you probably will one day. And if you don't face it here one day, you'll probably face it here somewhere else. Probably face it somewhere else one day. But our responsibility, Peter says, is to suffer joyously. To submit yourselves to elders. To submit yourselves to one another. To be joyous sufferers. And what is the result of that? What is the result of those who suffer joyously as Christians? What is the result for all of us if we suffer joyously as Christians? As he concludes there, he quotes from another proverb, Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 34. God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. If we suffer joyously, Peter says, the God of heaven will extend grace to you. That's what he said in chapter 4, verse 17. God is drawing eternal lines right now. The time for judgment is right here. It's right now. How are we going to live? How are we going to endure suffering? Will we be proven on the other side to be faithful to God, to be committed to God? Or will we prove ourselves to be opposed to God? Suffering and joy does not just occur among ourselves, however. And that's the last place Peter goes in this book. That suffering and joy is not just about how we submit to one another and how we endure through one another and with one another. But what Peter says is that suffering joyously is really much larger than that. Yes, we are to serve others joyfully as elders and as members, but finally we are to serve God joyfully. And if you've served God for any amount of time in your life, you are well aware that serving God is asking for suffering. Not because God is going to impose some kind of suffering on us. But as Jesus promised, if you're going to follow me, if you're going to be disciples of mine, you will suffer just as I suffered. And yet Peter says, despite the suffering, despite the trials, continue joyously. He says, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour, but resist him. Firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. After you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. To him be dominion forever and ever. Amen. Peter says, yes, you may be suffering, but continue to humble yourself under God. In the same way that elders are to continue serving the flock, in the same way that the flock is to continue serving the elders, in the same way that we're to continue submitting in various areas of our life, Peter says, above all, as we come to the conclusion of this book, humble yourself under God. Serve God. Suffering is hard. Suffering can zap the joy out of us. Going through trials can just take it out of us. But Peter encourages us to cast all of our anxieties on God. Don't worry, Peter says. Be happy. Rejoice in God. Rejoice in what God offers you. Now, obviously, this is easier said than done. You know, it's easy to get up and preach a sermon like this and say, you know, just don't worry. Just be happy. God's going to take care of you. But when you go out in the world and you say, this is hard. This isn't as easy as it's made to sound. This isn't as easy as Peter makes it sound. But we need to understand that the reason that we can do this, the reason that we can endure, the reason that we can be happy through our suffering is because of God's promise to exalt us ultimately one day. He has promised to exalt you at the proper time. That's what the end of verse 6 says. And really, that's what he got to chapter 4, verse 17. Isn't that what he was saying? The time of judgment is now. God is already starting to draw these lines. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. And if you prove yourself to be righteous, if you prove yourself to be committed to God through the suffering, then God will exalt you at the proper time. That's what he talked about at the beginning of the book. The resurrection of Jesus. Jesus has given us a living hope, something to hold on to, something to look to, by which we can have hope in the future resurrection that he has secured for us. God will exalt you at the proper time. Don't fear suffering. Rejoice through suffering. He tells us to guard against the adversary in verses 8 and 9. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour, but resist him. Be sober-minded, Peter says. Be alert. Don't let your judgment, don't let your mind be clouded. Don't let it be incapable of making good decisions. Back in chapter 4, verse 7, he said, the end is near. Be sober-minded. Think clearly about the things that you are doing, about the choices you are making. Because Satan, the devil, the adversary, is seeking to devour you. God simply gives the instruction through Peter, resist him. Did you know that this idea of resisting Satan can lead you to suffering? You know that resisting Satan can be hard. And there are times that in trying to resist Satan, you're going to encounter people who do not like that. And you're going to encounter people who will cause you to suffer, who will oppress you. It can lead you to suffering. It can be your suffering. It's hard to resist Satan. It's discouraging to resist Satan. But no, Peter says, that the same sufferings are being endured by Christians the world over. You're not alone in this. You've got people in this building. You've got people around Texas. You've got people around the United States. You've got people around the world who are battling the same battle you're battling right now. Rejoice in this suffering. Rejoice in the suffering of being a Christian, suffering for Christ. Because, Peter says in verse 10, after you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself perfect, confirm, establish, and strengthen you. To him be dominion forever and ever. Amen. Brief suffering is what we endure in this life. Brief suffering. And this brief suffering leads us to an eternal reward. The Lord has promised good to me. His word my hope secures. He will my shield and portion be as long as life endures. Are you suffering? Are you going through trials in your life? Do you have heartaches and pains, maybe physical, maybe emotional, maybe it's family problems that are weighing on you, whatever the case is, are you suffering? God cares about your suffering. God cares about the hardships that you go through. And we care, as God's people, about the hardships and the sufferings that we go through. Can we help you take full advantage of the hope that God offers? Can we help you turn your pain and suffering into rejoicing this morning? If there's any way that we can help you do that, we would love to have an opportunity to assist you, to pray with you, to study with you, to help you come to Christ through baptism. Whatever we can do to help you, why don't you come and make those needs known as we stand and as we sing a song of encouragement.